Okay, welcome to lecture 7. Okay, this is the beginning of a sequence of lectures where I'm going to talk about performance optimization. Okay, at this point, you have already got a pretty good understanding of the basic programming model. Okay, you know how to allocate memory, you know how to transfer data, you know how the threading structure works, and you have some good understanding of memory, special memory in CUDA, and how you can use some patterns such as tiled algorithms to get efficiency, and we even did some calculation, and so you can even in your head kind of do some back of the envelope calculation and see if things are making sense, and whether the bandwidth is oversubscribed. So at this point, I consider you to be an entry-level CUDA programmer. Okay, you should be able to do a pretty reasonable job putting together a simple kernel, and you can expect to be able to to understand any of these problems that the compiler may give you, and you understand the fundamentals of these APIs. So here we go. Okay, we are now into performance. And I said it once before, and I'll say that again, unless you care about performance, parallel programming is very easy, okay? If you don't care about performance, you should just enjoy the nice weather now rather than listening to me. You really don't have to come to the course for the rest of the semester. Okay? You're done, okay? You're done, okay? So, on the other hand, if you really want to, get performance and some payoff of parallel programming, this is actually the beginning. Okay, this is the beginning of your journey. So, in many ways, teaching parallel programming has always been hard for computer science departments, okay? And even in ECE departments in many ways. Because, we have all these conflicting needs of building, software features and reliable, somewhat free of bugs and so on. But on the other hand, when it comes to performance, you invariably start to have some tricky, decisions to make and structure of programs that, can actually make program less reliable. So unless you have a very solid way of arguing and reasoning about performance so that these things become your second nature. When you do performance programming, you can really become overwhelmed and start to introduce all kinds of random bugs into your process. So this is the reason why we are going to have the next sequence of parallel performance lectures. The purpose is really to make sure that you understand these things so well that it becomes a second nature. It becomes, just like when you drive a car, you don't really need to worry about, think about some of these things. And, all you have to do is to make sure you don't hit pedestrians and don't hit the car next to you or something, right? But if you constantly have to think about, if I step on this acceleration pad, what does that mean? Does it mean that it's going to, add some gas to the engine, or how's the gasoline going to go through that whatever piping system? If you constantly have to think about these things, it's very dangerous for you to drive, right? So we're going to start with kind of a little bit of a basic lecture on how GPU actually fits into the PC architecture today, okay? And it's not quite the inside the GPU, but it's actually one of those things that you really need to understand in order to understand how the CPU and GPU should work together, and how the data transfer really works, and eventually. I'm working with John Stone to try to come up with a new lecture on how to best overlap or eliminate the overhead or overlap the overhead of data transfer and at the algorithm level. But this lecture is designed to give you some context and some foundation
for you to really understand, you know, what someone like John Stone would be saying, or you know, what someone like, you know, some of these master CUDA programmers will be teaching.
So we want to understand the major factors that dictate performance when you use GPU as a compute accelerator for the CPU. And you know what, if you open up the machine, you're going to see, you know, the GPU plugged into the PCI Express, you know, slots these days. And you know what, so what you really need to understand, you know, after you look at that board, is you need to understand the feeds and speeds of the traditional CPU world. You need to understand how these paths actually look like. It's not that you have to think about it all the time, but once you really understand how it looks like, it becomes your second nature. Okay, you don't need to think about it anymore. So I'm teaching you something so that you don't have to think about it, right? So that, you know, that's the purpose. And the feeds of speeds when you employ a GPU, and how to form a solid knowledge base for, you know, a performance programming. And you know, what you also want to do is you want to be able to kind of understand what, you know, how these things look like before, which means yesterday, you know, what do they look at today? And you also have a sense of where these things are going so that you can, you know, quickly update yourself as these new things come out. Okay. And you know, the PC world is actually becoming flatter. Okay, so you know what, how many of you read that book, The World is Flat or something, that the book about outsourcing and global economy? Not yet? Definitely read that, okay? It's one of those books that I really enjoy reading. And you know what? So it's happening in a lot of places. And, you know, it happens in the economy of the world. It also happens in the PC world. For those of you who don't believe this, go online and search for the back and forth, back and forth comments between the NVIDIA CPU and the Intel CPU, and the, the NVIDIA CEO and the Intel CEO, okay? Just search for, you know, Craig Barrett, and search for Jensen Huang, and search for some of their comments about each other, and you'll get a pretty good understanding of, you know, what's going on in that whole world, because that world is becoming flat, and that world is becoming easier to outsource computation to these devices such as GPU. And whenever you have this outsourcing going on, you always get tension. Okay, if you don't believe this, go to some of these Ohio towns. If you go, you know, go to Michigan, go, you know, you will see exactly the same phenomena. Okay, so you know what? There's no magic in any of these things. You know, it's something that if you learn once, you can apply to pretty much anything in, you know, that you come across in all these different worlds. So you know what? Before we go into these, you know, PC architectures and so on, so let me just kind of remind you in the next slide that how the typical structure of a CUDA program looks like. So we use this main program here as kind of a symbol, right? So a symbolic representation of all these functions, CPU functions, where you use as a launching pad into GPU execution, right? And these functions tend to be the original function that does the work, right? Does the work on the CPU, but then you change that to a function that prepares the data structure, transmits the data structure to the GPU, and then you collect or harness all the results back into the CPU. So this is a very typical outsourcing, you know, model, right? Whoever used to do the work now become the coordinator, right? And then you know what? Then you get someone else to do that work. So you know what, if you look at the kind of the outline of that that function, you see allocate memory space on the device, you transfer data from host to device, and then you do an execution configuration setup, and after the kernel call, you transfer results back from the device to the host, and you know what, sometimes you compare the results. So all these sequences, you know, are implemented with API function calls, right? And those function calls are no magic, okay? These API features are implemented based on some kind of hardware support. And you know what, if the hardware is not properly designed, you'll get terrible, terrible performance. And you know, we're going to, you know, we're probably not going to have time to go into some of these very intricate issues with driver design and, you know, and so on. But one thing that I did mention a little bit at the beginning of the class is that the API functions, such as the memory transfer functions, okay, the transfer of data, like CUDA main copy, these are built on a CUDA driver, okay, that is especially designed to support computing. And you know what, that's why they can get much, much higher bandwidth, okay, data transfer out of these API functions. And so what I'm going to do in the next few slides is to actually take you through the sort of a more or less computer architecture way of looking at these things. But I realize that this is not a ECE 511, okay? For those of you who really, really want to learn this kind of stuff, you should take ECE 511. Or, you know what, I think to a certain degree, also CS 533. And you know what, there should be some, you know what, in-depth material about these things. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually put this into more a programmer's perspective. Okay, there will be something that looks more like architecture, but I will try to give you a slant and give you the perspective that, you know, would be more useful to you as a programmer. So for those of you who are CS and ECE grad students who really want to have infinite knowledge about these things, you know what, I may hold you back a little bit, okay? You may ask me some very, very, you know what, valuable questions and so on. You know, I'll invite you to come to my office and discuss with me, because, you know what, for the rest of the class, you know what, they may not add that much value, you know, for the purpose of programming here. So, you know what, the fundamental principle here is that bandwidth, as measured by the number of bytes you can transfer data between components in a system, is the most important governing rule of all these systems. Okay, when you have any weak linkage and under supply bandwidth to these data transfers, your entire system will run at the speed of that particular linkage. And that was actually part of the message that Dr. David Cook was talking about in his recent CS seminar. And you know what, it's really about how you balance out these systems so that all the bandwidth, you know, provided by the components, the linkages, all balance out so that you can actually sustain high application execution speed. And so what I would always like to say is that, you know, bandwidth is equivalent to the gravity, okay, in the real world. That is, you know, if you look at the real world, we operate based on gravity all the time. Okay, and you know what, gravity gives us all kinds of good things. You know what, I can actually stand here and you know what, I don't just kind of go to the outer space because of gravity. But more importantly, whenever you need to move from one place to another place, gravity is incredibly important. Okay, we can defy gravity a little bit by designing jet engines and you know, winds and so on, so that planes that take off, but they eventually have to come down, okay? And you want to make sure they come down in a nice way, okay? You don't want them to come down in a bad way. So gravity ultimately determines, you know, what we can do, what we cannot do in terms of transportation. Bandwidth is the same way. Bandwidth is actually something that is the hardest to cheat, okay? Among all the things in your system. If you don't have, you know, let's say if you have something that takes a long time to, you know, to access, you can cheat a little bit by caching, right? By caching things a little bit, by prefetching, you know what, doing things early and so on. But if you actually run out of bandwidth,
if you actually start to have a situation where you're using up all the, you know, all the possible capacity of your linkage, you get into a very, very bad situation. For those of you who don't believe me, you really should do yourself a favor, okay? Buy a plane ticket to Los Angeles, okay? And make sure your plan lands around 3:30 in the afternoon, okay? Go get a rental car and get out of the airport at 4:30, okay? Get on 405, Interstate 405, and drive to San Diego. If you don't know what I mean, do this once, okay? This is going to be the most worthwhile sightseeing tour you will ever have for your professional reasons. You will see all kinds of interesting things. For example, what should take 2 minutes can take half an hour, okay? And you will see that, you know, the traffic will go to a stop, and you will think that there is an accident. It turns out it's not. It may well be that a jerk decided to change lane, and the car behind it, you know, hit the brake, and then you have the braking effect, and you can just stop the traffic if you propagate that effect more than 20 cars. It's very hard to observe this kind of phenomena in Champaign, Urbana, because we cannot find 20 cars in a row. It's just impossible, right? So for those of you who think about going to Disney World for a, you know, Disneyland for a vacation, you know, those things are useless, okay? Make sure you spend a good day, you know, on the freeway learning all these things, and you will become a whole lot better programmer, whole lot better computer designer, and so on in the future, okay? And when you become very successful, come back and thank me for suggesting that very stressful, very frustrating, very angering vacation, you know, for you, okay? It's good for you, okay? So, you know, tricks such as buffering, reordering, caching, contemporarily defy the rules. Just like on a very crowded freeway, you can have all these, you know, methods. You can have these, you know, rest areas, you can, you know, so that people can go pee in a proper place rather than stopping the car in the middle and then, you know, pee on the freeway or something, right? Stop the traffic. So you can have all kinds of equivalent things that you can do, but in the end, when you have too many cars, it's over. Okay, there's nothing you can do at that point. And ultimately, the performance goals will fall back to what speeds and fees dictate. Okay, and you really have to respect that. That's the reason why, at some point, you know, the only effective way of dealing with these bandwidth issues is algorithm changes. Okay, you really need to be able to, you know, to eliminate some of these memory accesses. So the algorithm change that California, or state government did was what? Carpool lane. Okay. Fundamentally, that's the only algorithm change they had. So they tried to get people to carpool so that only fewer cars will get on the freeway. And what does that change? That changes the way the workers are supposed to go to, you know, each other's house, pick each other up. All those are algorithm changes, okay? And how successful is that? Not very successful. That's another thing you need to observe. Algorithm changes are always hard. So if you don't believe it, go and observe the carpool lane in Los Angeles, okay? So, you know, after all this, you'll become insightful, you'll become, you know, really, really good designers. Okay, so let's kind of talk about the classic PC architecture. Can you see the picture from the back? Should we lower the light a little bit?
Can we find the light switch on?
Let's turn off that light switch. Just
give it a try.
But does it help?
Yeah,
it helps. Let me see.
I think the light switch is there.
Oh, there?
No.
In the console? Here?
Program volume, computer. screen control. Light. Okay. Zone B off. Zone A off. Woo. How about this? Does it help? Okay, better? Okay. So, you know what? Yeah, John, this is good.
Okay.
Yeah, so you know what? Thanks. So, you know what? For those of you who have bought PCs in the past 20 years, occasionally you will hear some terminologies, okay? And these terminologies actually, you know what, gets reflected in this picture. So, you know what, if you look at the picture, we draw the CPU on the right-hand side, you know what, and it gets connected to something called the North Bridge. And, you know, North usually means, you know what, high speed and, you know what, congestion and so on, okay? And South usually means more relaxed, more, you know, kind of vacationing, and you know, when it comes to spring break, you're thinking about exactly the right thing, right? So, you know, if you stay in the North, you're supposed to see all kinds of, you know, busyness, and then if you go to the Caribbean and so on, you know, things go slower and, you know, things are a little better. So CPU goes straight into the North Bridge from the right-hand side. And that North Bridge is really the main hub, okay, main traffic hub of the system. And that North Bridge will connect the CPU to the memory bus, to the memory on the left-hand side, okay? So, you know, today, if you look at the North Bridge, you know, sort of the equivalent of the North Bridge, we're talking about somewhere around, you know, 8-9 gigabytes per second transfer rate, okay, on that North Bridge. And historically, you know, North Bridge, as I said, is designed to connect the very, very high bandwidth requirement components, okay, to memory. Okay, that's really the most important job. Getting a very, you know, providing a very fast path from the, you know, let's say the CPU into the memory system. And also, it became very clear that these PCs are, you know, heavily, heavily dependent on graphics processors, even early on in the 1980s and 90s. Because, you know, Microsoft and Apple started to do what? All these graphical windows, right? So, you know, as soon as the paradigm of user interface changed to these, you know, graphics-based windows, and you start to have all these kind of, you know, window overlap and, you know, a nice, you know, nice overlapping windows and then, you know, visibility and then raising, automatic raising and then lowering windows and all that stuff. Those things all require very high bandwidth data transfer from the main memory to the GPU, to the graphics processors. So that's why even early on, you know, people realized that, the graphics processors require a very high bandwidth access. But in that world, not all the processors are created equal. As Dr. King would attest in the 1960s, you know, not all the, you know, all the, you know, brothers are of the same right. And same thing with the components here. The CPUs and GPU do not have exactly the same bandwidth connecting into the North Bridge. Okay, the CPUs will connect to the North Bridge with 4 or 8 gigabytes per second. And then the advanced graphics port goes from hundreds of megabytes and evolve into something like a 2 gigabyte per second. And you know what, in many ways, this is a kind of a system design that makes sure that CPUs actually has the supreme, you know, access to all the important bandwidth and resources. And GPU will be serving its purposes, but it shall not be elevated to the role of the same importance, because fundamentally it will still have only 1/4 of the access bandwidth. Okay. And for the kind of, you know, Windows application and so on, you know, just this design it's not out of line. This design actually makes sense. It's a kind of a balanced design. And I would also argue that this is a reasonable economic decision,
in the sense that the graphics processors back then was mostly used for those kind of window, you know, manipulating kind of things, but really didn't require, you know, this exactly the same bandwidth as the CPUs. So then you have the South Bridge, which serves as a concentrator of all the slower I/O devices, your keyboard, okay, your, you know, your mouse, and your, you know, Ethernet, all these things, you know, are much, much slower than the internal, you know, data transfer. You say, oh, wait a minute, you know what, Ethernet is very fast, you know, I send a whole lot of data through the Ethernet. Yeah, but remember, you know, the Ethernet was what? 1 megabit per second, 10 megabit per second, right? Compared to the gigabit byte X transfer is tiny, okay? It's, you know, very tiny compared to the internal bandwidth. So that's why the South Bridge is kind of a, you know, serves as a little concentrator and say, okay, you all, you little guys, okay? You all get connected to the South Bridge, and I will just kind of concentrate all your data transfer needs, and then, you know, we'll only bother the real transfer, you know, path in the North Bridge when I put all these requests together and then do a kind of a big batch transfer, so that the transfers from the Ethernet, for example, does not always go and interrupt the higher rate transfer between the CPU and the memory. So the South Bridge actually does that coordination and makes sure that you don't have a constant interrupt into these, you know, high bandwidth transfer, you know, processes. Okay, so that's the old PC architecture. And even to this day, you should still have access to some of these machines that are built with the North Bridge and the South Bridge architecture. Okay, but they are slowly going away. In fact, at this particular time, they're probably going very fast away, because, you know, so you may need to save one of those North Bridge, South Bridge computers for historical reasons, okay, so that you can show your grandchildren that you actually have worked on some one of these machines. So when PCI, you know what, bus started to happen, you know what, the humble beginning of PCI bus was really meant to, you know, to provide a faster transfer mechanism for I/O devices, such as Ethernet, because the Ethernet was actually increasing in speed into, you know, 10 megabit Ethernet and then, you know, 100 megabit Ethernet and so on. So the industry started to see that, you know, you need to have faster and faster, you know, ways to connect these device, you know, higher rate like CD-ROM, you know, those things all started to have, you know, a little bit higher bandwidth, right, than before. So, you know what, so they specified the PCI bus specification, and originally this thing runs at 33 megahertz. And again, you're gonna see all these numbers, okay? I'm going to be, you know, kind of tossing these numbers around. And these numbers are extremely boring unless your life depends on it, okay? So, you know what, you don't need to really, you know, pay a whole lot of attention to these numbers, but at least you should have a sense of order of magnitude, okay, of, you know, these numbers. 33 megahertz, what's the significance? 33 megahertz is extremely slow compared to 4 gigahertz, okay? And you should be able to tell that, okay? If 4 gigahertz and 33 megahertz sound the same to you, then there's a little bit of a problem. Okay, whether it's 33 megahertz or 34 megahertz or 53 megahertz, that's less of a concern, right? So, you know, as a programmer, you know, the sense of order of magnitude is more important. So you started with 33 megahertz and 32-bit wide. So the bit rate or byte rate is 4 times 33 megahertz. So you get about 100, you know, a little over 120, you know, megabytes for transfer rate, right? Into the into your machine, and then, you know, more recently it became 66 megahertz, and, you know, 64-bit 512 megabytes per second peak, and these things allowed better and better CD-ROMs, okay, into your, you know what, to feed into your PCs, right? Remember those, you know what, times speed kind of thing, right? So, but still, the upstream bandwidth remained very slow for the device. You know, it's 256 megabit by peak, and it's a sheer bus architecture. What that means is that only one of the devices can be accessing that bus. Okay, so if you have multiple things that that require the transfer, they get into each other's way. Okay, you don't have a real guaranteed bandwidth. So if you really want to have a very high bandwidth device, such as a very advanced CD-ROM, oftentimes you will need to have some kind of trick to to guarantee some minimal amount of allocation of transfer to the on the bus. So this is the original PCI bus, okay? And for those of you who keep hearing about PCI, the original PCI is actually a bus that has several slots in the back of the PC box. Okay, so if you turn your PC back, you see several slots coming, that you can see the modem, you can see some of the keyboard interfaces. Those things all connect into that PCI bus. And they all kind of, share that same connection, and they all fight for that connection, and the hardware just kind of arbitrates and, give access to these devices. So that's the original PCI architecture. Any questions? Okay. And one of the features that the PCI have is what we call the memory mapped I/O. It's not a new concept. It's a concept that has been used in many, many systems in the past. But for PCs, the PCI, bus was actually one of the most organized memory mapped architecture, in that world. So the PCI bus allows the some memories or registers on these devices, okay, such as your PC, a CD-ROM driver, a CD-ROM player, okay. These CD-ROM players will have some internal memory, it will have some registers that give, that shows the status and allow the CPU to control it, right? And all these registers and internal memory can be mapped into the CPU address space. So this is something that I may need to explain a little bit for people who, who are from other, disciplines. So, remember when you, write your code, you will, you will access your memory, sometimes through, variables, sometimes through array, right? In the indices and so on. And what this thing does is to allow you to access the device, okay, like CD-ROM driver, internal registers, and so on, the same way as you would in accessing DRAM variables. So you can actually define some kind of data structure even, okay, that actually correspond to the, the device drivers. So if you have gone to Microsoft or some other companies and did a summer job on writing device drivers, okay, the device drivers today are all written in C, and you have these structs that actually represent the all these registers. So when you control the CD-ROM, make it run faster, slower, and all that stuff, you do so by writing into these C-level variables. And the reason why it works is because these variables are actually mapped by the hardware into the hardware registers and so on, that whatever you write at your program level gets reflected in the low-level hardware behavior, okay? And I'm not going to teach you exactly how the memory management works, how the TLB works, all these things. I'm throwing out some terms just so that you know that I actually, if you think that what I'm saying is too much architecture, I already spare you with, a good part of that, right? So, so what you need to take away from this slide is that, there's already a history of making some of the memory and registers on these hardware devices, okay, such as CD-ROM, such as graphics processors, visible to the CPU, okay, as a CPU accesses accessible memory, and the CPU program can somehow, you know, have access to it. Now, PCI Express is kind of an outgrowth of the PCI standard, but it actually makes several fundamental changes, okay, in the way the bus works. And through those changes, it has elevated itself from a kind of a rural, you know, transportation system for those slow I/O devices and so on, into the main transportation system for the entire city, okay, for the entire PC. And the reason why it can do so is because there are several important changes. On the other hand, whoever did this was very smart. Whoever did this didn't call it a new thing. They just called it PCI Express. Because whenever you have a new name, people feel that you need to sell this to them as a totally new thing. You need to re-establish all the stuff and politics and so on. So whoever did the standard was very smart in avoiding all that stuff. But underneath it, there's a very major redesign of the standard so that this linkage, this type of linkage, can be elevated into the main, you know, interconnect or transportation mechanism in the entire system. So it's no longer a shared bus, but it's a switched interconnect. Okay, and for those of you, you know, well, who wonder, you know, what's the difference between switched interconnect and the bus, right? A switched interconnect is like the old telephone system, okay? And for those of you who have seen some old movies, right, you have an operator sitting in front of a switchboard, right? And you have these, you know, things that the operator will plug and unplug. So when someone wants to call someone else in the city, they call the operator, and the operator connects the phone call, right? And then, you know what, so there would be a pair of interconnect. And then another person calls another person, you connect those two. So on the switchboard, you have these segments of wires that gets plugged in and out so that you make connections to the phone calls. Why does that matter? Because when you have a switchboard, you allow multiple of these conversations go on at the same time. Okay, by inserting those line, that's why those wire segments, you allow multiple people talking to each other without interfering with each other. What is a bus? A bus would be one of those walkie-talkie channels, okay? And have you gone to something like Disney World and then you try to, you know, to use a walkie-talkie to, you know, to connect with your family, right? And you know what? You hear all kinds of things on that radio, okay? And you know, you hear people, you know, getting really confused, and you know what, say, and then they say, "What did you say?" I said, "Who are you?" You know, so you know, that's sheer bus, okay? All the conversations go on, exactly, everyone can hear the conversation, and you know, everyone gets mad at each other, okay? So if we have a, you know, a phone system that's a sheer bus, you know, we can get into all kinds of interesting, juicy stuff of other people's lives, okay? Okay, so that, you know, that's the difference. Now, this is a switched interconnect in the sense that all the devices now have their private inroad into a switch. So the way for a device to talk, one device to talk to another device, is actually for the switch to put in that little wire segment, okay? And the number of wire segments you can put in determines how many conversations you can have, okay, simultaneous conversations you can have. So you can build more and more expensive PCI Express systems that allow multiple of these, you know, conversations going on, and so that you can have more guaranteed, dedicated transfer speed for some of these highly demanding devices. One of them is the CUDA GPU. Okay, This is the reason, one of the most important reasons why the CUDA drivers today can give you this guaranteed 4 gigabyte per second or 8 gigabyte per second data transfer, okay? Because you know what, they are actually, you know, set up in that switch so that you can get that guaranteed data transfer rate. Okay. In the old days, if you're using the AGB ports or the PCI, the old PCI ports, you would not be able to have that kind of guaranteed transfer. And you can actually feel the difference when you run these applications. So there is this concept of virtual channel, meaning that if you have a transfer that you need to do between the, let's say, the GPU and the main memory, then you set up a virtual channel, meaning that the switch has been instructed to connect, okay, to provide that little connection between the GPU and the memory, so that a whole bunch of transfers can go through that connection without reestablishing the switch, okay? So, you know, it's done electronically, that's called virtual channel. It's not done by an operator sitting on that switchboard inserting the wires, but it's actually done mostly as a software in the switch, running in the switch, okay? And so that allows you to do something like a real-time video streaming, and you know what, so that you can have, you know, uninterrupted pictures. So now, when you start to go buy these GPUs, okay, when you start to venture into building your own, you know, GPU CUDA system, many of you will probably end up doing so, okay? You will start to look to hear things like PCIe links and lanes, okay? So So a PCI link is really, remember, there's an inroad, right, from the device into the switch, okay? And that's what we're talking about here, you know, how you get into that switch. So each link, each PCI link can consist of one or more lanes. The lanes are really the hardware units, okay? These hardware units, what you'll literally see those, you know, wires and, you know, what they call the little wires on the PC board. What do they call them? Okay, it will come back to me. So you will see those little wires on the board. So each lane is logically a 1 bit wide, but 4 wires. Okay, it takes 4 wires to transfer 1 bit of information. Okay, to establish a 1 bit linkage. Okay, how many professors does it take to change a light bulb? This is exactly the same question. How many physical wires does it take to establish a 1 bit interconnect in the PCI? The answer is 4 wires. And it's really 2 pairs of wires. One pair goes up, one pair goes down. Okay, the traffic does not reverse on the wire. That's the first thing, okay? Because when you reverse the direction of transfer, it takes time, okay? So for very high speed data transfers, when you see a 1 bit linkage, it usually comes with 2 physical linkages. One goes up, one goes down, okay? So the entire thing is called 1 bit linkage. Why is it 2 wire pairs? Because the electrical transfer these days is not a single wire transfer, but it's a differential transfer, you know, mechanism. So you need to have 2 wires to establish that differential, and that differential gives you the signal, okay? And that's, again, the, you know, trait of very high speed electrical signal processing. The person who just took over NVIDIA research, Bill Daly, you know what, he was a professor at Stanford, and his claim to fame is actually, you know, in one of, you know, the most important thing is this kind of signaling, okay, on this kind of signaling mechanism, differential signaling mechanism. And another person, you know, who's also at Stanford is Mark Horowitz, who actually did a lot of the early development of this kind of, you know, physical signaling mechanism. And these things are responsible for getting those wire speed going up from megahertz to gigahertz. Okay, so you know what, you just have gradual, you know what, enhancement through the history with all these improvements. So each two wire pair can transfer 2.5 gigabits per second, okay? It literally changed the signal 2.5 gigatimes per second, okay, on those wire pairs. And because you have two pairs, you can have both up transfer and down transfer working at the same time. And that's why in CUDA, remember we said what? You can have 4 gigabytes per second transfer uplink, and you can have 4 gigabytes per transfer downlink. And you can actually, if you do the programming right, you can make those happen. And this is the reason. Okay, this is the reason why it can happen. Now, each link can combine, back up a little bit. The reason why this is very significant is because compute and graphics actually have very different requirements with respect to this one. If you think about graphics is mostly an output device, okay? Most of the data transfer happens from the CPU memory into the GPU, okay? You're dumping out a lot of information into the graphics card. But the graphics card seldom have to do high bandwidth transfer back into the CPU memory. So that's why if you look at AGP board, the data trend, the bandwidth to the GPUs are much, much higher, 2 gigabytes per second, but the uplink bandwidth is extremely slow, 256 megabytes per second. So by moving the GPUs from AGP ports into PCI Express ports, what does that do? That makes the upstream equally fast, and suddenly you can actually produce a lot of data, right, results from your compute, send it back to the CPU memory. Okay, and this makes the device a viable compute device. You can actually have some reasonable output, okay, to the system. Each link can combine 1, 2, 4, 8, 12, 16 links, okay? And so you will call them X1, X2, X4, X6, up to X16 in this example. So what X means is really the number of those lanes, okay, that you congregate into one logical linkage, okay? So you know what? The bandwidth of these transfers all have to do with how wide, okay, how many of these pairs do you put together, okay? So the performance scaling happens exactly the same way as our interstate freeway, okay? You actually, you know, add more and more lanes, right? And on the other hand, there's also a generation, okay? For each different generation, the transfer rate happening on that wire also gets increased. So you need to know which generation you're talking about and how many lanes you have. And for each GPU card that you're going to insert into your system, you need to know both types of information to figure out exactly how much bandwidth you're getting. Okay? Now, each byte data is really 8-bit to 10-bit encoded into 10 bits with equal numbers of ones and zeros. What does this mean? How many of you are like DSP, from DSP group? Okay, 1, 2, 3. Have you seen have you taken information theory and coding and so on yet? Okay,
So good. Then you know what? I can say whatever I want.
In fact, it's
something that if you're interested, you can actually do a little bit of project on one of the previous ESB students. I actually did a little bit of project. It was kind of interesting. So here is the deal, okay? If you look at a byte data that you need to transfer, okay, a byte data that you need to transfer, how many bits are there in a byte? 8, right? Okay. How many patterns, 1-0 patterns, can you have with the 8-bit byte? 256. And you look at it, these bit patterns are all over the place in terms of numbers of ones and zeros in the bit patterns. A very good example, number 0, right? Number 0 has all zeros, okay? And why is it bad? Because when you have these very high bit rate transfers, okay, you have these electrical supply, you know, these things are not magic, okay, so you have an electricity supply into these transmitters and receivers and so on. The kind of energy that it takes to transfer a 1-bit versus a 0-bit is actually different. And you're using these differential pairs, so you can start to have skewed electrical usage of these devices. And therefore, you can have a situation where the worst case energy requirement and worst case power dissipation is very different from the best case. Okay? You can have a very bad scenario where you're transferring all ones for a long, long time. And okay, that gives you one extreme usage. And then you have a situation where you transfer all zeros for a long, long time, you get another extreme case. Right? So this is almost like you can have designing a traffic system where you can have all just, 10-wheel trucks going on the same bridge for a long, long time, right? And then you have all pedestrians walking on that bridge all the time. And, think about how you're going to design that bridge. You're going to have to design a very wide range of, worst case scenarios, right? So most of these designers don't like that. Okay, and I wouldn't like it either. So what they did was they say, okay, let's take 10 bits to represent a byte. 10 bits gives you how many patterns? 1024, right? You pick 256 out of the 124. Okay, you pick 1/4 of those patterns. And those patterns will give you either identical number of zeros and ones, or at least close, okay? So that you minimize the probability of having all ones and ones zeros for a long, long time. Does that make sense? Okay? And that's why you are transmitting 10 bits to represent the information that you have in an 8-bit byte, okay? This is one of my favorite exam questions, okay? Yes. Yes.
I'm actually sending 8 zeros and 1 in order to.
No, it's actually more than that. It's not just adding 2 bits, 2 ones into the zero. It may actually be, it may well be something like 7 and 3. There is a mapping from that bit pattern into zero. Okay, so you may well be just a table lookup. Go on the web, and you should be able to find the mapping table. It's actually a standard mechanism. Okay, so you should be able to find that mapping table. It's quite clever, actually. And one of my former students, he's still a PhD candidate here, when he took my course, he's not my student, but he's one of the students in my department. When he took the course, before I finished the slide, he actually figured out that there's not enough bit patterns to give you all balanced results. So he actually figured out there was 4 short, okay? So that's the kind of mode I want you to be in, okay? When you listen, when you come to my lecture, I want you to, to be 3 steps ahead of me, before I finish the slide, okay? So this is my favorite example. But to his credit, he's the only one who has done that you know, to so far. So I would like to encourage more of you do so. Okay. So you know what? Essentially, you know what? You should be able to find 200 patterns with exact number, the same number of ones and zeros, and then you settle for some, you know, less balanced, slightly less balanced results, kind of something like that. Okay, so the net data rate. Oh, back up. So I just told you that I can transfer 2.5 gigabytes per second in each lane, right? But when you start to encode every 8 bits into 10 bits, you start to underutilize the resources, right? So effectively, you're reducing the bandwidth by 1/5, okay? So each link is effectively just a 2 gigabytes per second lane once you put them into the real transmission, okay? So that's why, you know what, the net data rates are, you know what, 250, 500, and so on, okay? So, so once you work it out, you will start to see that, you know what, these transfer rates are, you know what, you know, the way they currently have. So, most of the Gen 2, GPUs operate at a 4 gigabytes per second, which is X16. But you will also see Gen 3 or X32, so you will start, you can tell the bandwidth, you know, increased by, you know, going through those numbers. Okay. So what is a PCIe architecture? You know what, really what happens is that, all these things, the PCIe really forms the internet backbone. And North Bridge and South Bridge are now both PCIe switches, okay? So, you know what, the North Bridge and South Bridge are really just, you know what, memory bus and so on, they're all just PCIe linkages, okay? And they all feed into this the switch. And we still call them North Bridge, you know, just for historical reasons. But they're really just PCIe switches now, okay? And, some of the PCIe cards are PCI cards with PCIe bridge. This is one of those things that, you know what, that most of the computer designers hate and love, okay? When you build a PCIe card, you know what happens is that the whole industry doesn't move as fast as you would like them to, right? So you will have, you know what, let's say you have a manufacturing company in one of the South Pacific Islands or something, right? And then, you know what, these people are producing PCI cards. And suddenly, Dell calls them and say, from next quarter on, I'm only going to ship PCIe, you know what, PCs. And the engineer getting that phone call will start to curse and say, I only have PCI cards, right? So how, I'm gonna have to close the door because Dell is not gonna buy anything from me anymore. So Dell is gonna say, don't worry. I actually have a PCI to PCIe converter that you can quickly put into your PC, your board, okay? So then you can connect your board to the PCIe. However, remember PCI is much, much slower than PCIe. So you get a whole bunch of these cards that appear like PCIe cards, but they're really, really slow, okay? And when we build these systems, when we do these transitions, we see this all the time, okay? The industry does not move very fast. So when you go to the, you know, go to these places, you know, what's that, Best Buy, or you try to go to Circuit City to get the last board out of their, you know, out of business sale, you know, whatever, right? You know what, before you rush out of the store, take a look at the numbers. The fact that these things are PCIe boards doesn't mean that they really operate at PCIe speed, okay? And some of these boards that have not been sold for a long time,
there's a there could be a reason why they have been not being sold. So the fact that they're cheap, the fact that Circuit City is going out of business, doesn't mean that you can just run in and get aboard and hope to get a good stock. Take a look at those numbers, okay? Take out my lecture notes and match up the number with the, you know, with the number on that board, the box, and that can save you a lot of aggravation later on, okay?
Now, if you're interested in seeing in any, you know, more details of these things, take a look at the, you know, John Stokes PCI Express overview, okay? That really was well written, and you know, for those of you who really want to, you know, learn more about these things, you know, it's a really good bedtime reading, you know, really good stuff. Okay, so what is today's PC architecture? Okay, so you know what, if you buy a Intel machine, okay, you know what, literally the PC architecture actually look different whether you're buying an Intel chip-based machine or AMD chip-based machine, okay? And you will see some, you know what, fairly substantial differences. The Intel-based machine, you know what, now the CPU sits on top. You can tell that, you know what, this is provided by Intel, right? So whenever you see the CPU on top, it's always a picture, you know what, released by Intel. Whenever you see the GPU on top, it's always a picture released by NVIDIA, right? Or ATI, right? So you know what, it's just the nature. So the Intel processor will typically, you know what, feed into the, you know what they call the memory control hub, MCH. You see this, you know, quite a bit in some of these, you know, PC specs and so on. Okay, it's really called memory control hub, and that Northbridge is literally a PCI Express, you know, thing. And sometimes we also call the collection of the memory control hub and the Southbridge as chipset. Okay, sometimes. Because there used to be two chips. Now, you know, sometimes the two chips even get merged to one. So chipset is no longer a very, you know, fashionable term. So sometimes people call it core logic. Okay, but you also hear this terminology, meaning that it is a piece of logic that is sitting at the core of the machine, directing traffic, okay, among all the components. So that's why I call it core logic. So Northbridge handles the primary PCIe to, you know, video. So the, you know, you will typically connect your, let's say, X16 CUDA GPU card to the Northbridge. Okay, make sure it's connected to the Northbridge, not the Southbridge. Okay, otherwise you get into the, you know, the tractors and the, you know, the horse carriage and all that, right? You don't want to get into that world. And then the Northbridge handles the traffic, and then it gives you 4 gigabytes each direction and aggregate 8 gigabytes per second bandwidth. The Southbridge handles all these other peripherals. So you know what, if you look at the reality, the DDRs, this is one important takeaway from this lecture, okay? If you look at the reality of bandwidth, the bandwidth between the CPU memory and the GPU is not a whole lot less than the bandwidth between the memory and the CPU. Okay. You can still argue that the 8.6 gigabyte per second into the CPU can all be used for loads, reads, and all be used for writes. Okay. So in that sense, is still better than the GPU, because GPU, you can only have up to 4 gigabytes per second for the reads and 4 gigabytes per second write. These two cannot be combined into all reads or all writes, okay? So in that sense, it's still not as strong as the CPU connection, but it's getting really close. Yes?
What's the bandwidth between the CPU and the Northbridge? It looks like it's a 6.4.
Yeah, so this is one of the front side bus examples, but they're raising the, you know, they're also raising the bandwidth. So if you look at the newer machines, they're getting up to 8.6, and they're going up to, you know what, I think even up to 10 these days. So you know what, it depends on the generation. Again, you know, you need to see which generation of front side bus you're looking at. Okay, so if you bought an AMD box,
Okay, if your research group actually bought an AMD box, the internal of the AMD box is actually different. Okay, the AMD bus box uses a different. Back up. So I need to finish the PC architecture for dual core systems. So you know what? This is actually what you ask for the newer generation. When you have these, dual core chips, and typically you have two sockets, and each socket will have a two core, arrangement. Now they're being raised to four core per socket, right? But the front side bus has been raised to 10.5 gigabytes per second. And some of the lower end machines is 8.5 gigabytes per second. Okay. And you will still connect the, let's say the graphics processors on the left hand side. And for those systems, you have about half, okay, of the bandwidth going into the GPU than the CPU. Okay. So it's about half. So that's a kind of a good rule of thumb that you can use. And anything else? So yeah, that's pretty much. So for AMD, many of you have heard that there is the interconnect is called hyper transport. Okay. And this particular architecture is actually designed it's a design that was originally done by the Digital Equipment Corporation, what they call the Alpha team. And then eventually that gets adopted into the AMD product lines. Okay. And many of the digital engineers later on moved to AMD. And I still have a whole bunch of friends. And in fact, the president of AMD today is Dirk Meyer, who used to be a digital equipment engineer. Okay. So, companies come and go, but people are the same, okay? And remember this, okay? People are much more important than companies, okay? And Dirk Meyer is actually one of ours, and he is alumni of my department, and he's one of those, students that we're very proud of. And in a few years, I'm very sure I'm going to be talking about some of you, okay? So make sure that I have something to talk about, okay? I'll keep my life going. So the AMD Hyper Transfer technology, essentially replaced the front side bus with two things. One is, remember the front side bus was used to connect the CPU to the memory, right? To the memory. And it starts with 6.4 and then 8.5 and 10.5, right? Now, for the AMD, that connection actually gets moved, okay? To become a private connection from the chip. So the processor does not go through a switch to go to the memory. Okay, it does not. But it actually has a backyard. The memory is in the backyard, okay? And it will just go and access memory in the backyard. So as far as the processor is concerned, it actually provides a much, much higher bandwidth. The processor access to the memory is actually around 20 gigabytes per second. So that's part of the reason why Intel was under pressure from AMD when it comes to some of these very high data transaction-based systems. Because the memory access bandwidth is very, very high for AMD-based systems. Okay. Twice as much as most of the Intel systems today. Now, but it becomes a little trickier. Intel is not stupid, okay? So there's a reason why these things have trade-offs. So when you move your memory to the back of your processor, then CPUs have very high bandwidth accessing the memory, but everyone else who want to access the memory will have to go through the CPU. Okay, so let's say if you have another processor that wants to access, let's say processor on top wants to access processor on the bottom memory, then what the other processor needs to do is to actually go through the interconnect to the other processor and then go into the memory. And this is called non-uniform memory access architecture, NUMA, okay, for for those of you who are not familiar with this terminology, that means that you may have a system with a lot of memory, okay? And each processor will have access to its, you know, to a portion of the memory very fast, but then it will access other portions of the memory in the system a lot slower. Okay, it causes asymmetry. Okay, certain, you know, memory contents are much slower than other memory contents. It often causes headaches for software developers. It often causes headaches for memory allocation, you know, operating system and so on. But that's why a lot of the, you know, the systems don't take full advantage of all the memory in the AMD-based system, because, you know, it does require more software, you know, the software efforts in order to, you know, to take advantage of these things. So if you have an AMD-based system, okay, you're going to have an interesting bandwidth limitation as well, because the bandwidth into the let's say the processor has a 20 gigabyte per second access to the local memory, but the interconnect between the processor out of the processors and the internet connect between the processors and I/O devices are still equivalent to PCIe. Okay, the hyper transport physical layer is essentially a PCIe physical layer, meaning that the electrical signals and the kind of particular transmission receiver technology that they use are pretty much the same as the PCIe technology. Okay, so that's why when a processor needs to access some another processor's memory, the real bandwidth available is actually limited by the hyper transport linkage, which is 8. It was something like 8 gigabytes per second, 8.5, I think, gigabytes per second. So when you access the local memory of another processor, you no longer have that very high bandwidth either. Not just longer latency, but also lower bandwidth. That also means that when you have a PCIe, you know, a graphics processor attached to an AMD system, you don't get the advantage of the high bandwidth memory interface that the processor has to its local memory, because you're still going through the PCIe path to the memory. You don't have any direct access to the 20 gigabyte per second. So that's why a lot of people get really confused and say, oh, the memory bandwidth in the AMD system is so much higher, so if I use the graphics card in an AMD system, I should get a lot higher memory bandwidth. It's not true. Okay, that memory bandwidth is only available to the microprocessor itself. When you want to access that memory, you need to go through the microprocessor through a slower linkage, which is about 8 gigabytes per second. Okay, so that should bring us to, you know, what kind of today's AMD PC architecture. And, you know, it's a dual socket design, and it's a PCIe bridge, and then it's, you know, 8 gigabytes per second hyper transport, and then you have the memory cards in the back, okay? You have individual memory cards. And, you know what, for server architecture, this is a really, really good design. And, you know, that's why AMD has been doing extremely well in the server world. And in some of the PCs, when you need to have, you know, very high memory bandwidth for, you know, some of the gaming kind of things, you know, this can also make, you know, a lot of can make a lot of sense. And one of the things that AMD is trying to do is to allow people to plug in a GPU or so on and so on directly into the internal socket of the microprocessor. So instead of using two AMD processors, you might be sticking a single chip design, okay, a single chip alternative such as a GPU. And that's part of the reason why AMD purchased ATI, okay, and because, you know what, they see a possibility of, you know, having these flexible designs where they can just, you know what, make an ATI chip, you know, plug into this so that you don't need to provide local graphics memory in the graphics card. You can have a single chip insertion into the system and lower the entire system price for some of the middle-end and low-end products. So a lot of these mergers in the industry are driven by economics, okay? And a lot of these things,
have to do with how you can, you know, merge the management of the company so you can begin to streamline some of these redundancies and produce lower cost products. Okay, and once you understand these things, a lot of these things can, you know, be easily explained.
So, you know what, I'm going to let you kind of just go through the hyper transfer piece and needs, but the most important aspect is that, you know, you're really going to have, you know, about, you know, 1.1, 1.0, 2.0, you know, you do have higher, you know, speed as well. So, you know what, you're going to also see the AMD system scaling up in their future, you know, bandwidth, you know what, just like the PCI Express standard, they're almost going in parallel. So either you use an Intel system or AMD system, both companies will have the same, essentially similar roadmap in terms of, you know, the real bandwidth you can have in transferring data between the CPU and GPU. So if you look at a physical, kind of a physical picture of, you know, this is one of the older cards, but you know, I'm going to get someone at NVIDIA to give us a newer card picture. But you will see, you know, some things like you know, a cooling fan, and then you have 16x PCI Express. You know, so this is, you know, gets plugged into the motherboard. And then you have, you know, a DDR, a DDR memory, you know, on the chip. So it's about 600 megahertz, 8 pieces of memory. And these things all fit into a very, you know, just a card just like this. Okay, it's not a whole lot. And you know, you don't even see much of the card because that fan covers much of the card anyway. Okay, so you know what, this is the physical picture, and we are done. And starting next time, we're going to be talking about the internal architecture of the GPU, so that we can begin to, you know, to articulate some of the performance, you know, factors and how you optimize performance. Okay, so see you next. See you Thursday.